The subject, like I said, resisting temptation, is a subject that I'm convinced every one of us knows, can relate to. We know something about that. We deal with it every day in our lives. There's no getting away from it. Some days more than others, and sometimes more severely than other times. But we do know this, all of us relate to temptation. And something that I want to bring out before I forget it, sometimes people look at temptation as an evil thing. It's not. Temptation is neutral as far as morally evil. It's what you and I do with the temptation that decides whether it's bad or not. And I don't know if you realize it or not, but temptation is necessary for every one of us in order to grow. There is no such thing as a Christian maturing unless he's tempted. And so we mature because we resist temptation. We mature and grow in our faith and in our Christian experience through the temptations that God allows us. And that's what God allows us to experience. And that's why God does allow it. He knows that unless we face temptations, there's no way that we're going to get anywhere in our Christian life. So let's not look at the temptation as something evil. It's sort of like a red light. You drive up to a red light. If you go through the red light was not at fault. It was just, it offered an opportunity to make a decision. Really, temptation is an open door to make a decision. One way or the other. So let's not fear temptation, but just resist it when it comes from the devil, and when temptation is severe, we need to resist it. And that's what I want to talk about. It's something all of us would like to get rid of, but are subject to it as long as this life exists. I want to address this subject of temptation, and I think it's a very important subject to consider because of the consequences involved in it. And if we don't properly relate to it. So I'm going to read quite a bit of scripture this morning. Let's turn our Bibles to Genesis 39. We're going to read the first 20 verses. Genesis 39. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was in a goodly person and well favored. And it came to pass after these things, that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And it came to pass as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house there within. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, "See, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until her Lord came home." And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, The Hebrew servant which thou hast brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, After this manner did thy servant do to me, that his wrath was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph, and showed him mercy, and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. I decided to read a couple of verses further. But let's turn our Bibles to Proverbs chapter 7 as well. Proverbs chapter 7. My son, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers and write them upon the table of thine heart. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister, and call understanding thy kinswoman, that they may keep thee from the strange woman, from the stranger which flattereth with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement, and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way of her to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry and with card works with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the good man is not at home, he has gone a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech she caused him to yield, with the flattering of her lips she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, go not astray in her paths. For she hath cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is in the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. Very sobering. I'd like to draw our attention, first of all, to the life of Joseph. As I think of resisting temptation, I think he's a model. He's a real model. The text I read gives us a clear picture how this young man, Joseph, how he responded to temptation, how he chose to follow God's will rather than violate his own moral codes that he had. When I look at this young man's purity, I marvel. And I have a question. Where did he get that? How did he ever develop such strong convictions? I mean, the home he grew up in had great needs. If you study Genesis and if you study the home life that Joseph grew up in, there was a lot of needs in that home. And his own brothers were anything but godly. If you study his brothers' lives, here he was miles from his home, living with people who didn't blink an eye at immorality. I mean, he was not like he was surrounded with a church of people that urged him on. Here he was in a strange land and probably figured he'd never see his home again. And I marvel at his ability to withstand and resist temptation. He probably didn't expect, like I said, to see his family again. He was not a free man at this point. I mean, he was not. He was a slave. Adultery and fornication was common among the heathen nation that he was a part of. He was totally removed from anything godly. What kept him from falling? I mean, he could well have thought, what's the use? What's personal purity worth to a slave? But Joseph stood for what he believed. He could not be bought. However, his choice to resist temptation, it cost him dearly. Yes, he went from having one of the highest and most respected servant roles in Egypt to being sentenced to years in prison. And he was innocent. You know, there's a difference when a person is caught in doing something he knows he shouldn't be doing and when a person is lied about and framed. A person that is guilty cannot bear the punishment near as good as a person that is innocent. Now, we may think it's the other way. If I'm innocent, why am I being persecuted? Where's God? No. When you know in your own heart that you are innocent, you can bear up. But when you yourself know you're guilty, there's a condemnation constantly resting on you. And if you are not guilty, it doesn't matter what the consequences are, you are free within. You know, we must realize that apart from his prophetic dreams that he had no clue what was going on in his life. Not until years later would God's plan unfold for him to understand and see. However, let's back up a little bit here and see why perhaps Potiphar's wife was so attracted to Joseph. Verse 3 tells us that all that Joseph did, the Lord made to prosper. And you know what? Potiphar noticed this. He took note of that. Verse 5, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Even in the fields was evidence of good management. Potiphar noticed all this and probably spoke often to his wife about this wonderful youth, this wonderful slave they have, and what a capable young man he is, bragging him up. And to top everything off, verse 6 says, Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. Another translation says, well-formed and of handsome appearance. All this put together made him an attractive young man. Add his purity and godliness, that's another additive. Add his purity and godliness, and from Potiphar's wife's worldly mentality, Joseph became an appealing, you know, he became appealing to her to possess. So she openly and brazenly invited him into sin. Now let's look at Joseph's remarkable resistance. First, in verse 8 and 9, he tried to talk sense into her. He didn't want to become her enemy, and so he tried to get her to respect her husband. After all, he was her servant. But verse 10 indicates that she wouldn't give ear, but tried to wear him down day by day. Finally, Joseph knew that he had to stay out of her presence, so he refused to be around her. Don't forget these points. I want to take note of something. What makes Joseph's resistance and victory all the more remarkable is the fact that his knowledge of God's law was limited. He didn't have a Bible to study with the moral law like we have. It would be over 400 years yet before God before God's thundering voice would come from Mount Sinai. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That was 400 years yet to come. He did not go to church each Sunday to learn about moral purity. But in spite of his limited knowledge about God's laws, in spite of his bad example in his own family and the Egyptian culture that was around him, in spite of the natural opportunity to cooperate in a relatively safe, secret setting, Joseph still resisted. Let's look at three reasons why this young man resisted. Number one, Potiphar's trust. Joseph would not violate Potiphar's trust. "No one is greater in this house than I am," he told her. "My master has held nothing back from me but you, because you are his wife. There's something about a person's trust in you that makes you want to hold up to that. There's something, when somebody trusts you, there's something about that that makes you want to live up to that trust. Many dishonest people that could not be trusted dealt differently. They dealt differently with someone that openly trusted them, even though they weren't trustworthy. It just spoke to their heart when somebody trusted them. In fact, I'm leery about a person's integrity when I find out that he doesn't trust anybody. Let's look at the second reason Joseph resisted. Joseph would not violate his spiritual convictions. He would not disobey God. Though he was limited in his knowledge of God's laws, he had a personal relationship with God. He knew in his heart it would be wrong to get involved with Potiphar's wife. He had strong moral convictions. Verse 9, he couldn't bring himself to do this great wickedness and sin against God, he said. Let's look at the third reason. Joseph resisted Potiphar's wife for yet another reason. This one is not so evident in the scriptures. Nevertheless, I do believe it's there. You can see it between, read it between the lines. Joseph was concerned about God's reputation. All true believers should have that concern. Let's not forget that Potiphar was aware of Joseph's faith in God. He was very much aware of that. Verse 3 says, Potiphar saw that the Lord was with Joseph. Potiphar was aware that some superhuman power was evident in Joseph's life. He knew it was the God Joseph believed in, though he worshipped pagan gods himself. This is why Potiphar trusted Joseph so completely. Joseph knew that if he would violate the Lord's will in this matter, it would greatly, greatly jeopardize whatever interest Potiphar might have in the true God. And he was concerned about that. This was not a light matter for Joseph. And you know what? It shouldn't be a light matter to us. If we live a questionable life, we should always realize that it will greatly jeopardize anybody's interest in the God we profess to believe in. When we are tempted, we should always consider the far-reaching effects our response might have to that temptation. The devil is also aware of this. He knows, and how many times in you and I that we have known people over the past, prominent preachers, people that are well known, that were known for their integrity, that were known for their morality, and all of that, people that fell, prominent preachers of the gospel fell, and you know what? It turned many away that perhaps were seeking, many away that were considering Christianity. Let's consider some principles along the line of temptation. The first one we want to look at is accountability. Being accountable to someone can be a great help in our overcoming an area of temptation that we have a weakness in. The consequences for falling are heavier when one knows he must give an account to his actions to a trustworthy friend. We all know that we are accountable to God and that he knows our thoughts and intents of the heart. But because God, for the most part, doesn't deal with us immediately when we fall, we tend to lose our carefulness. It's what we would call the lapse of time between the sowing and the reaping. Galatians warns us not to be deceived in. Ecclesiastes 8 verse 11 says this way, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore, the heart of man is fully set to do evil. Being accountable to our families can be a great source of strength to resist the temptation. They trust us not to do something rash. And you know what? We don't really want to betray that trust. Many have overcome the temptation to commit suicide when they thought of what would happen to their family. Let's look at another principle. To resist temptation, We must avoid all verbal and visual stimuluses. We must avoid those things. What about movies, pornography, things that stimulate temptation? You know, we know what, all of you know what I'm talking about. I know people that are very strong professing Christians that watch horror movies, thinking they can get away with it. You know what? Their children are sitting there with them. I know this on a personal level. Their children watch these movies with their parents, and they have zero confidence in their parents' Christianity. There's a phrase in Joseph's story that is easy to miss, and yet is a key to overcome temptation. Not only did Joseph consistently refuse the invitation from Potiphar's wife, but he eventually refused to even be with her. Chapter 39, verse 10. You know, there are many temptations that are generated by verbal or visual stimulus. We can neither avoid them all, or, we can never avoid them all. If we would want to avoid them all, we'd have to be taken out of this world. And Jesus said, I do not pray that you take them out of this world, but that be kept from the world. What we subject ourselves to does affect our thoughts, our desires, and our behavior. And you know, you and I have a certain amount of control over our environment. Not always, but we have a certain amount of control over our environment, what we subject ourselves to. When we play with fire, we will eventually get burned. And when we play around with questionable areas or are continually around questionable things, we're setting ourselves up for a fall. We know that. Proverbs 6, verse 26 and 27. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not get burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not get burned? Let's remember, resistance to evil has steps. A step at a time. Seldom is one taken or caught with one step. In the scriptures, we read in Proverbs chapter 7 what Solomon saw and watched through his window and lattice, what he saw, and it demonstrates exactly what I just said. In verse 8, we find this young man void of understanding. It says that's the first thing that you notice when you read that chapter. He's void of understanding. He's a fool. This young man, void of understanding, passed through the street. Where? Near her corner that he knew she would be, or often is. This was a mistake. He was looking for trouble. And when he couldn't find her there, what does he do? He goes by the way of her house. He's bent on trouble. I believe the drastic difference in the ending of this young man and Joseph had to do with the steps they took that led to the final temptation. Joseph obeyed 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 22, abstain all appearances of evil. Whereas the other young man took no heed to Proverbs 4, verse 15, avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it, and pass away. You and I have a responsibility. We can't just say, well, God put it there, therefore I can't help myself. The devil made me do it. No, no, no. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it and pass away. The one used wisdom, while the other threw all caution to the wind. Proverbs 2, verse 10. When wisdom entereth into thine heart. I give this verse a thought, long thought this morning. And I thought, how inviting, how comforting. When wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee. Have you ever feared of losing out? Have you ever wondered if you're going to be true and faithful unto the end? Listen to this verse. When wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, you know what? Discretion shall preserve thee, and understanding shall keep thee. Verse 16, to deliver thee from the strange woman, and I like to take that word woman and translate it to the world. To deliver thee from the world, even from the stranger which flatters with her words, or even from the temptations of the world. Look how two Old Testament saints handled this principle of avoiding temptation. Daniel and Job. Daniel purposed beforehand in his heart not to defile himself. He probably knew beforehand that sooner or later he's going to face the temptation that he faced. And you know what? He was a strong believer that an ounce of prevention is far better than a pound of cure. And then look at Job in chapter 31, verse 1. I made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a maid? Job is saying, I promised my eyes and made a rule with them not to look upon a tempting sight. I won't go there. I will not look the second time. I know I related this before here in the church back some years ago, but I had a good friend of mine that had a dog. And he had chickens loose in the barnyard, and the dog was loose. And this dog got to killing the chickens. Well, he finally knew he had to do something about it. So somebody told him what to do. He went and got one of the dead chickens that his dog had killed and tied it real close up to his collar of the dog and just left it there. And that chicken rotted on the collar of that dog. That dog was so sick of chicken that after it was over, Joe told me that the dog would lay out in the sun in the barnyard, you know, and he'd lay there half asleep, and the chickens would come scratching and walking up toward him, and he'd see the chickens, he'd turn his head the other way. Could we learn from that dog? I will not look the second time. That's what Job said. How do you and I respond to temptation in the area of avoidance? I mean, one of the keys to victories in this area is to know my limitations, to know my weaknesses, to beware my weaknesses and conscious of my limits. Avoid all appearances of evil. Then take steps to avoid this area, like Proverbs says, turn from it, pass not by it, pass away from it. When you know you have a problem with food, do you hang around the refrigerator? If you have roving eyes, do you watch the road or the sidewalks? What about the checkout counters? The devil knows where to put that stuff. When you're waiting on the cashier and you don't know what to do and you let your eyes wander, do you avoid it, pass it not by? If you have a weakness for pretties and questionable clothing, do you spend a lot of time window shopping? If your weakness is computers, cell phones, etc., do you make a conscious effort to avoid it, pass it by, or at least spend a limited time with them? If you are easily discouraged and naturally negative, where do you allow your thoughts to wander to? Remember, prevention is so much better than seeking a cure in these areas. So much better. You see, so often we could make it so much easier for ourselves if we would take measures like Joseph and not even go near the temptation. But too often we play around with the thought and begin to reason with it. And you know what? We set ourselves up for a fall. Many don't take advantage of the steps of resistance, and they end up falling a lot lower than they thought they would ever fall. Let's consider another truth about temptation. Did you ever consider the fact that you are seldom tempted in an area where you are strong? Satan doesn't waste time tempting you where he sees little possibility of tripping you up. You don't waste a lot of time there. It's where we are the weakest that we're tried the hardest. Satan is always on the lookout for weak spots in our character. Where one may be severely tried, another isn't bothered. We're not the same. We don't face all the same temptations. When you are weak in character before conversion, look out, you will most likely be tempted after you're saved in the same area. There's something I'd like to share with you at this on this area of resisting temptation, and that is no option. I've shared some of this before, but if you make something that is not optional for a Christian, if you make that optional, you will be severely tempted in that area. But if you never allowed it to become optional, the devil doesn't bother tempting you there. He knows that he won't get anywhere. It's not an option to you. My wife and I are married 51 years, just about. And we have not always agreed in everything. I can say I spent 51 years of bliss. But we didn't always agree. But you know what? Divorce was never an option. I never even gave it a thought. You know what? The devil never tempted me in that. He can't get a hold of anything. It's when you make something that is non-optional, optional is where the devil gets a grip on it. And that's what I say. Every marriage, every person, every young person that enters marriage should have a steadfast understanding between them that divorce is not an option. Now, I'd like to consider some practical common temptations that we often face and how we need to respond to them. There are many that we face that perhaps are not as openly sinful as these that we read about here, but nevertheless, each one has its roots in death. Give that some thought. These temptations, they all have their roots in death. And if not taken care of, will lead to death eventually. When we talk about temptation and how we need to respond to it, we immediately must recognize that it all begins in our mind. The battle's in the mind. That's where, for the most part, that's where it is. The battle's in the mind. There is where the victory is won or the battle is lost. There are times when temptations come in a literal, tangible form, where the attack not only comes through the avenue of our imagination in the mind, but is intensified through the messages given by our five senses. This is temptation at its worst. The more of our human natural makeup that makes contact with that which is not permitted, the severer the temptation. This is why memory can be the cause of intensified temptation. Let me illustrate. The person that was once an alcoholic and got delivered, his temptation to go back to the bottle is much stronger because of memory than for the one who never drank. He not only imagines and remembers, and because of this, he not only imagines, but he remembers. And because of this, the temptation becomes almost irresistible. Now, this is where I say that this is where children raised in a godly home have the advantage. I know there are people that feel that you shouldn't be shielding your children all the time, that they need to be exposed to things in order to let them grow and mature. There's a certain amount of truth to that. But you have to decide as a parent whether it's worth it or not. Because exposing our children to all kinds of ungodliness so that they learn to resist temptation can be a very unwise choice. After all, my children never faced some of the temptations I faced. And I know Gideon can tell the same, and a lot of others here. Some of the things we faced that we were not taught against, some of the things we were exposed to and were never taught that it was wrong, and those kind of things, our children never had to face those temptations because they were never exposed to it. We shielded them from it. And the advantage that a child has growing up in a Christian home is tremendous because he doesn't have the temptations stimulated by experience beforehand. Let's look at some common temptations and how we need to respond to them. I'm going to give a few, especially for youth. Let's look at some temptations that can develop between young men and young girls. There's a certain amount of reserve. I believe strongly in this. There's a certain amount of reserve that should always be maintained between the opposite gender. It's only proper, it's only carefulness. If not, certain individuals can easily pick up a wrong message. This leads to expectations that are ungrounded. Imaginations soon develop into wrong conclusions, and this soon becomes an open road to heartache and disappointment. Let me illustrate this point. A young lady takes note of some special attention she's receiving from a young man. And since she is friendly by nature and human enough to enjoy his special attention, she is tempted to respond in such a way as to encourage him. I can relate to this. I had a daughter that was very outgoing and very much she just liked everybody and wanted everybody to like her. And so she was very outgoing. And you know what? A lot of young men got the wrong message. And that's not what she was interested in. And it caused a lot of, you had to clear things up in a unhealthy way. But anyway, she's tempted to respond in such a way as to encourage him. How should one respond in such a critical situation? That's a good question. You have this person, it can be a boy as well as a girl, that is by nature very friendly, by nature outgoing, by nature attracting to the opposite gender. How should that person respond, and how should you deal with this thing that can encourage interest when there really wasn't the interest the other thought there was? I don't know how some of you feel about this, but I'm going to tell you how I feel in a very just short sentence. The pure in heart does not encourage affection when not free to return it. Another temptation for young people is to feel they are more mature than they really are. They get impatient with mom and dad and, they wish they'd get rid of some of their old values. How do we respond to this one? Think a little bit and consider. Not only are your parents responsible for how you turn out, but they have the advantage of having passed through and graduated from your stage of growth. Old people know a lot more about what it's like to be young than young people know about what it's like to be old. Someone has said a child is about as mature as his ability to understand his parents' point of view. And very closely related to this one is the temptation to run ahead of God, wondering about my future. Boys, girls, listen. Wondering about my future. Lord, I'm getting older. When are you going to get to take up my case? When will you get to me? Listen, if this is not rightly responded to, another one will come on top of this one, another temptation. The temptation to lower your standards as bait. And when you yield to that one, you are inviting trouble. I'll tell you why. Because anyone that comes to that bait was not worth waiting for. Let's look at some others. In Matthew 4, we have the three temptations Jesus was faced with. If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made into bread. Let's look at that one. Trying to find fulfillment in the natural. If thou be the Son of God, make these stones into bread. Verse 2 says Jesus was hungry. He had fasted for 40 days. Now, I don't think it would have been wrong for Jesus to eat at this point. I don't find that he had made a commitment or a vow to anyone how long he would fast. But the the reason that I believe that Jesus resisted this temptation, I believe, was twofold. First, he was not about to break his fast because Satan suggested it. He'll do that when the Holy Spirit releases him to do it. And he wanted to make it clear that the natural, though necessary, wasn't what was important. Man does not get his real needed nourishment from the natural, but from the spiritual. In Luke 12, verse 15, he brings out the same thought, or the same point. A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. In other words, real fulfillment is found not in the natural, but in the spiritual. And those of us who are born again, we know this. We have experienced that. This was Christ's response to his temptation. What is ours? What is my response? What is your response to that constant temptation to find fulfillment, all my fulfillment and all my joy and all my longings, to try to find fulfillment in the natural? There's nothing wrong with enjoying life. But when your pursuit is nothing but pleasure, when your pursuit is nothing but entertainment, you're going to have an empty life. And I know that by experience. I remember well as a young man, before I got saved, my wife and I got saved, we were always looking for something to satisfy, something that kept us going. Like the songwriter says, something deep within, something deep inside of me keeps me moving aimlessly. Something I can't explain. I'm a traveling man, was the song. You know, there's something that moves all of us. And if we try to find full fulfillment in the natural, we will be disappointed. I remember very well as a young man, we looked forward to this and we looked forward to that. And when it was all over, it was just that letdown. Now what? You had to wait like another push on the wagon. You know, when we were little kids, we'd push each other on the wagon, and we'd one sit on the wagon and guide the wagon, and the other one would push, get a hold of the back of the wagon and run behind it and push it until our legs were so tired we couldn't hardly go anymore, and then we'd give the wagon one last hard push and stop and stand there, and the wagon would go for a while, and then it would stop. And you know, the little kid on the wagon waited for another push. That's exactly how a lot of us grown-ups do. We're waiting for another push. If that is where you try to get your fulfillment, you're going to be disappointed, because even though you may be flying on the wagon for a while, it's going to stop. It's not lasting. How do you and I respond to this inner void, that God-given inner hunger for fulfillment? Where are we going to find satisfaction and fulfillment anyway? The devil may not tempt us to make stones into bread, but he certainly has a lot of material things to hold before us to replace what we really need. There seems to be no end. Actually, really, there seems to be no end. What the prince of this world has on display to attract us, to draw our attention to seek satisfaction in. Can we say with our whole heart the song we sing? Hallelujah, I have found him, whom my soul so long has craved. Jesus satisfies my longings. Through his blood I now am saved. Or are we still feeding on the husk around us? What does my home, my business, and my everyday life testify? Is it an overwhelming testimony that Jesus is my all in all? Does it openly declare with the songwriter, take the world, but give me Jesus? Young people, how are you responding to this temptation? What if a total stranger became your silent shadow and observed your life? What impression would he get? I said, young people, this is for every one of us. What if he walked into your room and looked around? What if he looked at the books you read and the things you take an interest in? What would this complete stranger find in my life? If he just silently went through my house, through my place, through my whatever, my study, the books I read, internet I watch, what would he find? Would it be clear to him that I'm getting my satisfaction from the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal? A good indication of how you are responding to this temptation is by what sparks your interest. What do you like to talk about? What kind of conversation draws you out? You know, the devil didn't shelf this temptation when Christ didn't fall for it. This temptation is one of the most used in our day yet. How do you respond to temptation in your thought life? How should you respond? How do you sort through these temptations? How do you know the difference between the voice of God and the voice of Satan? They're not always easy to distinguish. One needs to get familiar with the Word and know how to use this sword of the Spirit for protection. But too often our minds are filled with earthly things. And when an intruder shows up, we don't detect it until he becomes that intruder, that thought becomes a deed. Anger shows up, and we give him our emotions. Revenge needs a place to stay, so we show him his room. Frustration shows up, so we tell him to pull up a chair. Pity wants to have a party, so we show him the kitchen. Lust rings the doorbell, so we change our attire. Listen, do we have to put up with this? Don't we know when to shut the door? Don't we know when to say no? Remember, we don't have to go through this. How are we supposed to respond to these things? 2 Corinthians 10 verse 5 tells us to take every thought captive. How is this done? Let me illustrate. A thought approaches your mind, a questionable thought. Do you throw open the door and let that thought in? Do you give it a chance? No, you take this thought captive. You stand at the door with handcuffs, and immediately when that thought comes, you immediately take him captive. Any thought that is not fit to enter, you get control over. Take, for instance, the thought concerning your personal value. To some people more than to some others, this temptation boldly comes to you and approaches your door and says, "You're a loser," and you know it. All your life you've been a loser. You have blown relationships and jobs, and you might as well give up. It's no use. What do you do? I'll tell you what a lot of people do. They will open the door and let him in. "You're right, I'm just a bum. Come in. Let's have a pity party." But not the Christian, not the victorious Christian. He immediately handcuffs him and marches him down to the courthouse, down to the street to the courthouse. There he brings him before the judge, God's word. "Jesus, this thought showed up a little bit ago at my door, and he says, 'I'm no good, I'm a loser, now that I will never amount to anything.' What do you think?" If Christ agrees, let him in. Listen to what the judge says to the Christian. "We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them." Or check out Romans 8, verse 1. "There is now therefore no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit." Find out in God's word what your condition is. Many instead try to find out what their identity and how they feel. In closing, I'd like to turn to 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. "There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common unto man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer us to be tempted above our ability to withstand the temptation, and will also make a way of escape so that we are able to bear it." We pass over this too quickly, and we forget the word "wherefore" in verse 14. "Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee idolatry." What is he saying? God is saying, "I am so powerful and yet so gentle and considerate that I will not allow to come your way any temptation that is beyond your resistance. each one is carefully measured according to your power to resist it. And with each one, I provide a way of escape. That's a promise. Then he uses the word therefore or wherefore. Because of this. Because I'm able to take care of you. Flee idolatry. What is he saying? Flee from the very idea of putting stock or weight or trust in anything else but me. Don't even consider any alternative for security. Turning our Bibles to Matthew 4, after the three severe temptations of Christ, we find these short, comforting words in verse 11. Then the devil left him, and angels ministered unto him. God bless you.